My 24-year-old, I have two kids, 24 and 22. My eldest 24-year-old lives with us and has since the beginning of the pandemic. And so he has been in my life as a part of this journey where I decided to run for Congress and had my wins and had my losses. And I can see in his eyes an even greater respect. I mean, we have a great relationship. I've never not felt respected. What I'm saying is he has watched me handle shortcomings, disappointments, failures, and I'm not trying to hide it from him. I'm not trying to like fall apart in front of him, but I'll walk into the house and be like, well, I just blew that. Oh, I feel terrible. He's watching me process the disappointments of life. He's watching me process the imperfections. And occasionally he will say to me, thanks for just talking about this, Mom. I really appreciate seeing how adults solve problems or how adults cope with, you know, difficult things. And it makes me realize that my partner Dan and I shielded our kids through their childhoods from so much of the hardship and the disappointment. We tried to have disagreements out of their earshot. We tried to not share any of the challenges with them. We wanted childhood to just be roses and unicorns. And I think there's a lot of positive, you know, we want our kids to have a positive childhood, but we don't want to make them think that it is without, it never has stumbles.
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jesse LeBeau.
Everybody, it is the amazing, the incredible Julie Lithcutt Hames. And how are you doing today?
Jesse, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. And I also want to just thank everyone who's stumbled upon this, wherever they're listening in whatever technological format. We are grateful you've decided to make us a part of your day.
I love it. And so you were recently doing something. You were running for a position in some sort of office. What was that all about? Can we get a little inside scoop on that?
You think parents want to hear about that?
I think everyone's like, a little curious.
We can have lives beyond raising our kids. Yes, I live in Palo Alto, the heart of Silicon Valley in Northern California. I am on the city council here, which is a very busy position.
Oh, yeah.
Not a full-time job, but very busy work. And our congressional seat came open here at the last minute in late November for a primary in March. And I threw my hat into the ring. So first time the seat had been open in 32 years. It was held by a woman. And I saw a lot of guys stepping up. And I thought, where are the women in this American moment? We don't want to be losing female leadership in Congress. And I thought I really had something to offer with a progressive agenda, really centering our youth, frankly. How can we once again be a community where youth can afford a place to live and, you know, their wages and salaries will pay for their various bills and we can pay attention to their mental health and address climate change? I was really running not for myself as a 56-year-old or my generation, but to try to create a better society for the youth of my region and more broadly in America. Alas, I did not make it past the primary. I had to finish top two. I finished eighth out of 11. Yeah. Very, very humbling experience, but really glad that I ran. I think I was the lone woman running against 10 guys, and wow, just that alone made for, I think, a unique voice. I'm proud of myself for trying to step up and do that.
That's so cool. And probably kind of out of your wheelhouse of a lot of the things that you've been doing leading up to that. What are a couple, I'm so curious, of the takeaways that you learned from this new experience and stepping outside of your comfort zone to do something that you felt like needed to be done, you felt called to do?
Yeah, thank you for that, Jesse. Gotta tell you, I'm 56. I've kind of been a lifelong learner. I've got a couple of graduate degrees. I've always, you know, academia has been pretty close to my heart and my life. But I have rarely felt as intellectually challenged as I did in running for Congress. Part of it was the breathtaking pace. It was a short, we had 3 months of a primary and then boom, an election. And so every day I woke up and I knew precisely what I was meant to do with every moment of every day. There was no let up. It was exhausting and intellectually stimulating. I had to move from somebody who cared about climate change to understanding how the Inflation Reduction Act was, you know, giving off dollars to support the generation of clean technology. I had to go from values and beliefs that I could espouse at a cocktail party to being able to answer substantive questions about what's good, what's bad, how do I know, what would I do, and why.
Man, and that's a whole different thing.
I loved it in front of lots of people watching.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was intense. It was dynamic. It was scary.
Yeah, I love that.
And, you know, I think, you know, when you've been a high achieving person, to go back to square one in some ways, like be a newcomer at something, is very humbling. And I frankly think that's good for us. I think it's good to start something new and be a learner and be a beginner and you know, just try your best and accept the stumbles and the, you know, I come off of a public forum, a debate, an interview with a newspaper trying to decide if they're going to endorse me and think like, wow, I blew that question. Yeah. Oh, I blew that other question. But look what I did well. I really have, you know, to really take the wins where they come and to learn from the losses. And this was a wonderful opportunity on both of those fronts.
I think that's so important because so many people today, especially young people, are afraid to take chances and afraid to fail. Where when we look at anyone who's been successful, it's almost always a path of fail, 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 a little small win, fail, fail, fail. And that's just part of the path to success. So I believe so strongly in modeling things, whether it's how much time you should be spending on your phone or what a good, healthy relationship looks like. And that's what kids are looking up to and seeing. So I love that for you at 56. You're like, you know what? I'm going to try something totally different and go for it. And it is out of my comfort zone. I am going to blow questions in these different interviews, but that's okay because I'm going to learn from it. And so just a tip of my hat to you right now.
And I got something to say in response to that. Can
I? Yeah, yeah.
Is that all right? Okay. Yeah. Number one, my 24-year-old, I have two kids, 24 and 22. My eldest 24-year-old lives with us and has since the beginning of the pandemic. And so he has been in my life as a part of this journey where I decided to run for Congress and had my wins and had my losses. And I can see in his eyes an even greater respect. I mean, we have a great relationship. I've never not felt respected. What I'm saying is he has watched me handle shortcomings, disappointments, failures, and I'm not trying to hide it from him. I'm not trying to like fall apart in front of him, but I'll walk into the house and be like, well, I just blew that. Oh, I feel terrible. He's watching me process the disappointments of life. He's watching me process the imperfections. And occasionally he will say to me, thanks for just talking about this, Mom. I really appreciate seeing how adults solve problems or how adults cope with, you know, difficult things. And it makes me realize that my partner Dan and I shielded our kids through their childhoods from so much of the hardship and the disappointment. We tried to have disagreements out of their earshot. We tried to not share any of the challenges with them. We wanted childhood to just be roses and unicorns. And I think there's a lot of positive, you know, we want our kids to have a positive childhood, but we don't want to make them think that it is without it. It never has stumbles. To your point, we know here in Silicon Valley, we know that success comes only after repeated iteration and failing and faltering and learning from it and keeping on going. Like, we know that conceptually, our businesses know it, but parenting today tends to be about every moment has to be perfect. We're worried that if it's not perfect, you won't get the right grade. Tomorrow in your sixth grade math class means you won't get to the right college and have the right life. Like, everything for modern parents feels to be of consequence for our, we think it matters for our kids' future that everything be perfect. Therefore, we don't tolerate the imperfection. Therefore, we're more likely to micromanage so that they don't get the bad grade. Therefore, our kids are afraid to take chances and fail, which is what you opened this commentary with. Like, you can see the connection. They're afraid because we've taught them to fear failure. We've taught them they always have to be amazing. Of course, they're anxious. Yeah. Of course, they're fearful. We've created an environment where that's the norm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely crippling, and COVID didn't help. And we do phone calls every week with parents, and I see that so much. And it gets smaller and smaller things, and it can be they're terrified just to have an interaction with the barista at Starbucks or to go out to school and get out of the car and walk into the school body and interact with other kids. So I'm glad you brought that up, Julie, because I discovered you, and you probably have never heard this before.
What?
But from your TED Talk, which I just checked before this. It only has 7 million plus views, and that's just one of them. So there's probably a lot more views than that. So, of course, I'm kidding. Yes. I send that TED Talk that you did to every parent that comes into our different programs or that I come across because of some of those things that you were just touching on. Would you mind sharing how that TED Talk came about and why you felt so passionate about sharing that message that has impacted so many different people all over the world?
Oh, Jesse, thank you for being a fan of my TED Talk and driving more people to it.
Yeah.
Like you're responsible for many of those views. Look, I was a college dean at Stanford University working with undergraduates from the early 2000s all the way up to 2012. I had noticed an encroachment into the lives of young adults by well-meaning parents who were just trying to make sure everything was fine and good and successful. I was seeing the outcomes of that. I met with students who were still being handheld by their parents, and I met with students who weren't. And often it was the poorer first generation, lower income students who weren't being micromanaged because their parents didn't have time. Yeah. It was the affluent kids who were handheld too much, and however bright and brilliant they were and accomplished academically, they were, I called it existentially impotent. They were not familiar with their own self. They were like a puppet on a string or a dog on a leash, you know, or a thoroughbred in the Kentucky Derby, but someone else was cracking that whip and telling them where to go. And I was like, wait a minute, what's going to happen to them? When are they going to yearn to be off leash? What if they don't? What's going to happen to them? What's going to happen to society? All of that led me down a path of writing about this kind of micromanaging parenting, impact on mental health of the young adult, impact on skill development. And I ended up writing a book. Here's my original copy of that book, How to Raise an Adult, which is the book on which the TED Talk was based. So I write this book. It does very well. It comes out in 2015. And by 6 months into the life of this book, TED had reached out to me. Actually, 3 months into the life of this book, they're like, yo, we think you should do a talk. Do you want it? You don't say no to TED. Although, let me tell you, it's one of the scariest things I've ever done is prepare for that TED Talk. No notes allowed. Memorize a 15-minute speech and, rehearse. And so what an opportunity, because it allowed me, you know, this message in book form is one way to try to teach people that our kids, as I say in the TED Talk, are not bonsai trees, which are carefully clipped and pruned to look the way we need them to look. Our children are wildflowers. That is the point of the talk. Don't clip and prune them to resemble what you think the ideal child looks like. Instead, provide the environment, you know, sunshine, water, metaphorically, the soil. Create the environment in which your wildflower, meaning you don't even know what it's going to become, but your job is to help it become itself. That's, I think, the imperative from God or the universe or whatever your belief system might be about kind of the bigger purpose as parents, not to control and clip and prune and shape, but with humility and curiosity, step back and watch this little person become who they are and discover it along with them.
Why do you think parents do that? I feel like I see a lot of that as well. And it comes off to me like it's an extension of the parents. I don't want to say it's always ego, because I don't think it always comes from that place. But sometimes it feels like they were the star athlete, so they want their kid to be the star athlete. Or they were the brainiac, smart student, and they want that for that kid. Do you feel like it comes from a selfish desire that it's about them? Or they're really just trying to help their kid be as happy and successful as they possibly can? I know every case is scenario, but
different
with all the students and parents you've seen, why do you think parents do that?
I got a lot of different thoughts. You've sort of named some of them.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'll name some of the causes. I think parents absolutely, if they're the star football player they were, or they are a doctor, they know that led to security, praise, a sense of accomplishment, success for them. Why would they not want that for their kid? It's the only path they know, they've known, and they're trying to make sure their kid is, so they have the sense of, I did it, you should do it too, it worked for me, it can work for you, which is not ego, as you've said, but more like, let me teach you how to be successful. Be a football star, you know, be an investment banker. Like, that's the way, kid. The trouble is, if that kid's not made out to be a football player, let alone a star, or doesn't have any inclination whatsoever toward investment banking, then they feel dragged down the path of life behind their very successful parent who's demanding that they do this, and maybe whose love feels conditioned upon whether they do it, right? So as parents, we have to interrogate, is this really the only path to success just because it's what I did? Aren't there myriad paths? Why, yes, there are. So, this is what I've done, you should do it. Then there is a sense of scarcity, like, I fear the world's resources are shrinking. I need to make sure my kid gets access to them. You know, this is what they should do in order to have the kind of material possessions that I think they need. And it begs the question, what is success and how much of it is money and how much of it is deep satisfaction with your work, right? So I'm constantly pushing on that. I think there is ego. People will approve of me if I can say my kid's doing this, right? Yeah. I need my kid's accomplishments to happen so that I feel soothed and sated. My insecurities are addressed because I can prove how good I am through how good my kid is. And boy, is that problematic for a kid.
Yeah, yeah. It is such a difficult thing. I always talk to people and I'm like, it's so difficult to be a teenager today, but it's also difficult to be a parent.
Yeah.
And it's just difficult to be a person in general, I feel like, a lot of times. What do you think? I don't
know.
That's
so beautiful, Jesse. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's just
hard. Difficult to be a kid, difficult to be a parent, difficult to be a person. Amen.
Do you feel like from, let's say, 20 years ago, it's more difficult to be a parent today? What's your honest thoughts on that?
I mean, as with almost every answer I will give, it's like yes and no
balance, nuance,
right? Because, for example, I'm Black and biracial, okay? And this is a little tangential, but I just want to say, when I was born in 1967, when I was being raised in the 70s and 80s, I was an oddity. People didn't know what mixed race was. They made fun of us. There was no room for us. There was no category. And I think it's easier to be mixed race today. And yet,
yeah,
you know, white supremacy is on the rise, and, you know, there's a lot of hate coming the way of those of us who are different. And so it's another example of it's harder and it's easier. You know, I think in many ways it's easier to be a parent because look at your podcast, look at all the work you put out there, look at all of the information we have access to 24/7, 365, and every device and good old fashioned books. You know, parents can learn more than was ever possible to learn before. They can be in community with other parents whose kids are in school refusal, right? They can be in community with kids whose parents are anxious, right? They can be in community with other parents, is what I'm saying. Like, technology, the internet, social media have brought parents more opportunity to learn and feel less alone and be supported. At the same time, you know, we've developed a parenting style that is so, they call it in some ways concerted cultivation, like every moment of your child's life must be handled by you, planned by you, attended by you, in case it has to be fixed by you, right? There's become this normalcy around, almost like your child is a fragile thing in a greenhouse, and if it's not carefully watched by you at all times, it'll die. Therefore, it's not true, but that's the norm, right? So then it's like you don't have time for your primary partnership, your spouse, your loved one, right? You don't have much time for anything extra at work that might delight you. Just like, get through work, you know, let me talk to my partners. But like, everything has become so stressful because micromanaging a child's life is now so much a part of every parent's day. Our parents did not do this. They had love, they had work, they had hobbies, they had downtime, they relaxed more. You know, we thought the technology and enhanced, you know, like 21st century, life is going to get easier. It has only gotten much more stressful. There is far less time. So in many ways, it's so much harder to be a parent now because we think this micromanagement of our child's every moment is required to keep up with the Joneses, to make sure our kid doesn't fail, to make sure every opportunity comes their way. And we can't look after our own bodies, our own health, our relationships, our friendships, hobbies. It's just, it's become really, really exhausting.
What a just amazing segue. I feel like this is going really well because I wanted to talk about your new book that you're working on right now. It feels like some of this stuff, and I've heard it called, and I'm stealing this from Dr. Phil, but concierge parenting, where you're attending to their every want and need and driving them to this and that and just providing for them in every way at all times. Do you feel like that leads to a failure to launch? And what are some of your thoughts on what you see with kids that have moved on from their teen years and are in their 20s, early 20s, and dealing with that difficult time of, I want to be an independent adult, but I still am going through college or getting my first job and figuring out how to provide for myself financially. You want the independence, but you're not quite always there yet, and you still need some help and assistance from your parents. So tell us a little bit about your thoughts on this book and why, you know, there'll probably be another TED Talk, I'm thinking, for this one coming up soon.
You know, I think Dr. Phil invited me to be on his show. And I think I had to turn it down because I had just decided to run for Congress. I was like, I can't. I'm running for Congress.
I don't have time.
I can't be on Dr. Phil. Yeah. And so now I'm like, ah, I should have been on Dr. Phil. It would
have
been really good for my future book. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I've said, it's all nuanced. It's all kind of, it depends. I agree with Dr. Phil that a concierge-style parenting approach, which is, I will drive you everywhere, I'll handle everything, I'll fill out every form, you know, follow you around with anything you forgot, it undermines the kid's ability to build skills, responsibility, accountability, autonomy. And there's also this looming mental health problem that comes when you're constantly attended and handled. You don't develop agency and resilience, so which undermines your mental health. So concierge parenting, I agree, problematic, and definitely, I think, leads to this, what we call failure to launch. That is,
yeah,
the adult, the chronologically adult kid who really can't do anything for themselves outside of significant special needs. I mean, like they can't do because they were never allowed to / asked to / required with the smaller things along the way in childhood that would have set them up to be the adult who can do the adult level things. Okay. And there are so many young adults who are not failing to launch, but rather are living with their parents in their 20s because their wages and salaries do not pay for rent, because leaders, society, macroeconomically, we have failed to ensure that we've built enough housing so that there's enough housing, supply and demand, like there's enough housing so some of it's not expensive and you can pay for it with your right out of high school or right out of college wages and salaries.
Yeah.
Any kid, you know, working full time but can't afford rent, let alone a mortgage, let alone, you know, buy a house, right? That's not inherently failure to launch. That's who can afford it. They didn't, nobody,
yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
was paying attention to the macroeconomics for younger millennials and Gen Zs. That's not their fault. And then you have the kids who are dealing with learning differences, neurodivergence, so much more common in young adults. They have a different way of thinking, a different way of being. The world they find themselves growing up into isn't necessarily accommodating of that because they're not understood. We're in the middle of a shift where we're acknowledging, accepting, working with like all of these human differences. But to be the generation that is really the first to emerge out there and say like, I'm neurodivergent, you know, make room for me in this world. Like they're demanding a place in a world that is still in some ways a 20th century boomer led world. Look at the two people we have as choices for mainstream choices for president of the United
yeah.
States. They're all
yeah.
from the
yeah.
silent
yeah.
generation. Like they're not even baby boomers,
yeah.
you know? And
so old.
They're so old.
They're so old.
Right.
That's
so
crazy.
So my new book, you know, which is I'm proposing, it's for parents of 20 somethings. And it's kind of like, I won't give a title yet. I mean, this is all just a book proposal, but like, I'm trying to say, if this is what you're encountering, here are ways in which you can support your adult child in thriving, developing the skills they might not have yet, you know, providing the support they still need while transitioning them to be more, you know, capable of kind of looking after themselves, because one day you'll be gone. We want them to be okay when you are. But what I'm also hearing from parents is, I have needs. I might have
yeah.
a 25-year-old who needs me, but I've got aging parents. I got my health issues. I'm trying to retire with some money. Like, How, parents needs matter too. So I'm trying to help parents see, like, more than ever, you have to center also your own needs. If you're to be of any use to this kid, you know, you don't want to be, you know, so helping this kid that you become this helpless 80-year-old because you gave all your resources to your kid. And now your kid has to look at, like, we have to have this healthy interdependence. And young adults tell me, when I say I'm writing this book, they're like, would you please tell our parents about boundaries? And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, I live at home. I work full time remotely. I'm at work at my laptop working. And mom just waltzes in and starts talking to me as if I'm her friend and we're having a coffee date. And I'm like, mom, I'm working. Yeah. And I love that because I never expected 20-somethings to say, oh my gosh, my parents need better boundaries. Of course, the parents don't even know the language of boundaries unless they've been in therapy because we didn't grow up with this, right? So parents are like, what do you mean? I'm just, you know, like, okay, right? Don't use me as your therapist, kids will say. Don't just assume I'm available whenever you just want to drop in into my workspace, which is, you know, my laptop. Yeah. Come on. So parents have to learn, have to pivot, even as they're trying to teach their kids how to learn more. So this book is going to try to address, like, we're all learning and growing here. You know, like, we are all, we're this interdependent, like, we have to figure ourselves out. And also, how do we support each other and have the right communication and the right boundaries? It's like, you know, it's a magical new way of being. And I think parents are ready for it. And I think adult children are ready for it.
The world needs this book because I think
that
is something.
Did that sound
compelling? Parents are like, hey, I had him through 18 and now I thought I was going to get my space and I was going to be dealing with empty nest syndrome. And they're still here. They're still here. But that makes total sense. The economics of it makes it very, very difficult for. And I hear young people sometimes bad mouth and older people, they're like, oh yeah, boomers, when you were a young adult, you could buy a house for $20,000 or $30,000. And I'm like, well, it is difficult. It has changed a lot.
It has. It 100% has. And when I hear boomers, which tend to be the grandparents of the young adults we're talking about, when I hear them say, what's wrong with you? In my day, I owned a house. I had a wife. Like, okay, Grandpa, times have changed. Minimum wage, when FDR created minimum wage, Franklin Delano Roosevelt created minimum wage. He said, it shall support a man and his wife. Everyone was, you know, heterosexual then, right?
Yeah.
A man and his wife and a child at more than subsistence wage. He said, it's not just bare subsistence, right? It should support a minimum wage to support a man, his wife, and their kid. All right. Nowadays, minimum wage will not even, in many places, allow you to support yourself. Rent, food, healthcare, car, like the basics. Okay. Yeah. That's not the failure of the people on minimum wage. That is the failure of a society that has overlooked how cost of living has gotten completely out of control. And we blame the people who somehow are not wealthy and have it, you know, all handed to them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different times for sure. So I'm curious, Julie, on the front lines, and by that I mean as a parent of two children, what are some of the lessons you've learned along your journey of things you feel like you've done right that you would recommend to other parents? And a couple things that you feel like maybe you made the wrong decisions and you would advise parents to do the opposite or at least not do that. Do you have a couple tips from your personal experience?
Yes. The beautiful, ugly, horrible irony, Jesse. Here I was writing this book, How to Raise an Adult, Don't Micromanage Your Kids. Let me do a TED Talk.
Yeah.
Then I come to appreciate, oh, shoot, I'm actually the concierge parent for my kids without realizing it. And my big aha moment was one night I started cutting my 10-year-old son's meat. And, you know, you shouldn't be cutting the food of a 10-year-old. Again, barring significant special needs and they don't have the fine motor skills, you're supposed to have taught them to use a knife and fork before they're 10.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh gosh, I'm not going to be able to let go of this kid at 18 because I'm cutting his meat and he's 10. I have done that to him. Okay. So that's
okay.
And there are parents listening who are like, oh, I'm still cutting my 11-year-old's meat. And yeah, they're going to make them cut their own food tonight. Okay?
Yes, please.
So it really gets to, you're supposed to be teaching them, not doing everything for them. You know? And
yeah.
Cutting food and, you know, you being the one to look both ways as they cross the street at 8 and 10 and 12. Like,
yeah.
You're supposed to teach your kid to look both ways, or else you're metaphorically carrying your kid through life, keeping them safe without ever having taught them to keep themselves safe. Okay?
Yeah.
I want to say the other tip is don't swoop in and solve, empathize and empower. Okay? Mm. Swooping in and solving happens with problems and it happens with feelings. If it's a problem, instead of like, oh my gosh, I'll handle it, you know, forgotten backpack, you know, something, some snafu, you empathize and empower. Empathy. That's awful. I'm so sorry. Are you okay? I love you. Ugh. Like nice words of comfort.
Yeah.
Empower. How do you think you're going to handle it, buddy? Says, it's a problem. It's not my problem. It's your problem. And I think you can, which is what's missing from modern parenting. And I think you can. Modern parenting is, I don't think you can. Don't worry. I can. Okay?
Mm.
So instead of swooping in and solving, empathize and empower. How do you think you're going to handle it? Just kindness and like support. You're evincing belief that you think they can. The second thing is feelings. When they have big feelings and you want to make the feeling go away or tell them it's not as bad as they think. No. Empathize and empower this way. Empathy. Thank you for sharing. This sounds hard. Do you want to tell me more? I am here for you. I'm not going anywhere. And then after that, you can say, do you want some ideas or do you just want a vent? I'm here for either. And let them choose. Okay? Because you want to give your ideas. You want to fix it. You want to solve it. You want to handle it. You want to tell them what to do. And all of that says you can't handle it yourself. Here's what you should do. Terribly disempowering. Okay? So switch out.
Yeah.
Swoop in and solve. I'm going to swoop in and solve for empathize with what's going on and empower them to make the decision, make the choice. You know, tell you what they want next.
That's so good. And I see that all the time where it's coming. I'm just going to solve every problem. And then they don't have those skills.
Right.
I don't know who said it, but I say this all the time. It's about preparing them for the road ahead. Instead of running ahead of them and clearing out the debris on the road and smoothing out the bumps, you want them to be able to have that grit and that resilient. And I like the way you said it. Will you say that again? It's like carrying them around.
It's and like you're still carrying them on your shoulder.
Yeah. Right? Yeah,
as if you will always be able to, and you won't, because we're mortal, and we'll be dead one day, and we hope that happens before, right? We hope that they outlive us, right?
Mm.
And you don't want your child to have felt carried in the nook of your neck all their life so that when you're gone or infirm, that all of a sudden they feel abandoned, lost, and they know they don't have the skill because they've never had to do it. It feels loving to do this. It's actually more loving to do this when they're one and then set them down, hold their hand, walk with them, still walk, let go of their hand, still there, and then they can walk by themselves over a period of time, right?
Yep. Yeah, I've heard it said, I really like this one, it's like every time they accomplish something, whether it's a small win, one step in front of the other, learning to walk or doing well in school or making a friend, it's like you start to get these a stack of proof that you have this undeniable little stack sitting here that you can do things and you can accomplish things and you don't need to run to mom, you don't need to run to dad to solve all of your problems. It's like, no, look, here's the things I've done. It like I've actually achieved and accomplished some difficult things that were hard and it was hard and it was difficult and I failed, but
there were things
that I was able to do. So I love that as far as like, you gotta do these things. Like life is hard. I have these conversations a lot and parents will be like, you know, they just don't want to do things or whether it's like being a part of a program that's going to help them with these things. And I go, totally understood. They need to be on board because that's how they're going to get value out of this. But at the end of the day, these kids are still having developing brains and their parents need to step up into a leadership role and go, hey, you're going to do this thing that's uncomfortable and you don't like to do, or you're not going to do this thing that you want to do. Maybe it's being on your phone 24/7 and having untethered access to the internet, even though all the other kids have it. Like, I'm telling you no because I love you. That's how I'm showing you that I actually love you, is doing something that my life would be infinitely easier just to give you the iPad when you're a little kid and you're making noises and being loud in public. But I know that it's in the best of your development. And I'm going to show you I love you by not just choosing the easy thing on my end. Do you find that as well? Sometimes it's hard to say, it's like choosing your hard. Like it's this hard thing in the short term for something that is going to be a beneficial big payoff in the big picture.
Absolutely. And I think what you're hitting on is an example of the sea change in parenting from how boomers and Gen X were raised, mm-hmm. which was with more authoritarian parents. My way or the highway, because I said so, up and out at 18. I don't care about your feelings. Go cry somewhere else. There was a harshness to the way kids were raised in the older generations. And many of us, you know, in Gen X and then millennials are trying to be kinder with our parenting approach than our parents were. And so we have a hard time saying no. And I will put myself in that category, you know, really had a hard time saying no, didn't want to upset my child, wanted to work it all out. And the first big no's happened in his 20s. And I remember one day he was so upset in response to what we were saying. It was almost like he was having a tantrum. And he'd always been a really well-behaved child. And I turned to my husband, I was like, it's like he's two. He's having his first two-year-old tantrum now at 20 because we're finally setting some boundaries.
Yeah.
And having to say no. And, you know, I put that on us, not him. You know, I mean, no is a really important. I tell parents these days, you know, empathize, empower, put the phone down and walk away. If you get that text, which is, you know, I left my backpack at school. Oh, empathize. I'm so sorry. I didn't know how frustrating that is. Poor thing. You all right? Empower. Let me know how you handled it. Or how do you think you're going to handle it? And then put the phone away. Because they're going to be like, what do you mean? You need to come. I need to just be like.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have to walk, smile and walk away. Not to abandon them, but to signal, you've actually got this, kid.
Yeah.
You've actually got. This is yours, not mine. I love you. I'm making dinner. You know, let me know how you handled it.
Yeah. Put the ball back in their court of, hey,
like
you
that.
Created this. Now
like
you're going to have to be creative and problem solve of how
That's
you're going
right.
to do it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or come up with a really good apology for your teacher tomorrow when you tell them I left my backpack.
Yeah, 100%. So I'm wondering if you were going to go through a wormhole in time and you were in a parallel universe and you knew all the things that you know right now and you had a 10-year-old who you weren't chopping up the meat for, you were making them cut their own food, but now there's this device called a smartphone. What would be the guidance and advice you'd give yourself for handling having a teenager, a young adult, a preteen with a phone?
Well, we know that Jonathan Haidt's new book, The Anxious Generation, is really having quite an impact. He's really done the research, assembled the research that says smartphones and social media have really been problematic, have really harmed kids. And it's not just the only thing. He would say that, you know, they don't play freely anymore because they're on their phones. We know how important free play is. He also knows that micromanaging concierge parenting doesn't help. But I would go back armed with Jonathan Haidt's research, and I would say to myself, wow, the whole internet is available to my child on this device, all the pornography they could ever want, all of the, you know, scary facts about this and that they could ever want. Are they ready for this? You know, no. Okay, let me be the parent that can say, I don't care how exciting and glamorous this device is, and everyone seems to have one, we know you're not ready for it. And I would follow the advice in The Anxious Generation, which I think says no smartphones until 16,
14.
14, he says. Yeah.
Yeah.
And no social media until 16.
I would
follow Jonathan Haidt's advice. And I would also try to be in community with other parents around this, because we feel we got it. You know, we don't want to be that parent that, you know, prohibits our kid from doing what all the kids are doing. And yet we know we have to keep them alive and safe. So, you know, we have not realized that the internet and social media and smartphones are in that category of things that can really harm them. And the sooner parents appreciate that that's the truth, the healthier kids will be.
Yeah, I really hope that we can see, like you said, a community of parents coming together and really being leaders and saying, hey, I know that a lot of other people are doing this, but this is something we're going to decide in our household. And the more people that can do it together, because like he talks about in that book, it's really a lot of times the fear of missing out. It's that FOMO of like, well, I'm not going to know the funny video or the trend or the meme. And so they are afraid to be the one that doesn't know about what's going on. And the only way to change it is if these parents collectively come together and say, hey, these are going to be our rules. There's going to be some limits. There's going to be some restraints. And the research is very clear. So I love that. I have become absolutely obsessed with this topic because almost every conversation I have with a parent these days or kids that are in our programs, when I look down to it, a lot of it, whether it's this epidemic of loneliness or whether it's them not being able to connect with other kids, being antisocial, the anxiety, I can almost go back to the parent and go, well, what's their relationship like with their phone? And they'll get embarrassed, and I'll go, what apps are they on? Do you even know like how much time they're doing? And they'll say, yeah, I don't even know, but I know it's a big problem. And anytime we try to take the phone away, it's the end of the world, and they absolutely lose out. And then a lot of times parents will give in because they're like, well, I'm creating more of a problem by taking away now, which I totally understand where they're coming from, but it is just, you know, what's the expression? The love of money is the root of all evil. Like, I've been feeling more and more in the last, like, 6 months. It's just like, man, it seems like these smartphones and social media are the root of all evil. And these kids don't stand a chance, in my opinion, to be able to resist this technology that has trillions of dollars put behind it to capture our attention and hardwire and hijack our brains and all these things. So, man, I love that message that you just shared.
Preach. You're sharing it. I love your preaching on this, Jesse. You know, I loved how you just put it. How are our kids possibly going to withstand a force that has billions of dollars of marketing and algorithmic, you know, intentionality around drawing them in further? It's an addiction, yeah, essentially, in the making that, you know, we've put in their hands. And, you know, usually kids have to, like, go buy cigarettes for themselves or go make a fake ID to get the things we know are not good for developing brains and bodies. But somehow we've handed them a smartphone, you know, with all of this in it, designed to pull them into places that, you know, magnify their worst feelings, you know, and their worst thoughts. Oh, so look, it's time. And I'm glad you've been obsessed with it for 6 months. And you know, I'm concerned about it too. You know, thanks to you and others and Jonathan Haidt and other writers, you know, people are starting to get the message. We've got to help empower parents. Like you said, be in community with other parents, be the leader so you don't feel alone. Like when I'm giving talks on my book, I'll say, look, I go home tomorrow or I'm going home tonight. Raise your hand if you want to continue the conversation. Who here is willing to raise their hand and say, what can we do in our community in furtherance of not being the concierge parent or in furtherance of let's not have cell phones in our schools anymore? Hmm. Let me ask you a question, Jesse, because I think the one question that's really hard to answer is, given the violence in America today, given the propensity for gun violence, how would I not let my kid have a phone at school? What if it's the only way for me to be in touch with them should something terrifying unfold? What would you say to that?
Yeah, and unfortunately, in some of those more recent ones, the kids have phones, and the police wouldn't even go in for whatever reasons. I don't know if, you know, there's so many different things that you hear in the news and you never know what to believe. But according to Jonathan Haidt in the research, he would argue that it's actually safer today than it's ever been. Right. But we are aware of more of these things. And I believe the thing that really changed public sentiment about this was what was the show back in the, I think it was the 80s or 90s, America's Most Wanted. And so people would watch this and they would see, oh my gosh, at any moment, my kid can be abducted and go missing and never come back again. So the reality is when you're put in, just like with social media, when you see these things over and over again that are sensationalizing it, it's actually safer than it's ever been. That being said, if I'm a parent, I want to be able to communicate. I want to put a tag in them so I can see where they're going to be at all times and protect them and do anything that I can. So that's the problem with a lot of these things. And I feel like it's the same thing whenever I watch any of the documentaries on social media, is these guys are the expert. They say how bad it is. And you're like, oh, yeah, without a doubt. Like, and then you go, well, what's the answer? And they go, I don't know. We haven't figured that part out yet. So, I mean, as far as them having a phone in case there is an incident at a school like that, it feels like they need to have it. But I think the difference is having a smartphone that they can communicate with is the difference between having something that gives them access to the internet and social media at all times. Yeah. So being able to make a phone call and make a text message is different than them being like, all right, well, let's just do the endless, mindless scroll. So that would be my
two cents. A flip phone, a dumb phone, whatever we call the opposite of smartphones. Yep. No access to the internet, but access to the 911.
Yeah, and to or limited access to the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that would be my two cents on it.
Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I've enjoyed this conversation so much, and I wanted to ask you, and I know I asked you earlier, but is there anything as we've talked or just that you've been thinking about lately? Obviously, the kind of failure to launch topic on your book, but is there anything on your heart that you would like to share with your parents that are in your community or the people that are listening to this right now, just that you think could be encouraging to them or that has made a big difference in your life? I'd love just to give you a moment to share if there's anything just really on your heart.
Thank you. What's on my heart as a parent here in Palo Alto, heart of Silicon Valley, San Francisco Bay Area, is that our kids' mental health here is, and in the aggregate, really quite poor. We know this because we've had a number of youth choose to end their lives by suicide in the recent years, and we struggle, I think, with. We don't want to talk about it. We want to just sort of push it under the rug. We want to make sure there are more mental health providers. But I want to invite parents to the conversation about what could we be doing. Like, we need to rescue kids who fall into the river. That's the mental health support. But what do we do to not have them jump in the river in the first place or fall in the river? What are we doing in our narratives, in our communities, in our schools, in our families, at the dining table? What are we saying and not saying about success, about what we value in humans, so that, you know, we end up raising kids who feel loved unconditionally, that their interests and pursuits are valid, that they can be, you know, whatever it is they work hard and want to be, as opposed to, you have to be this, you have to get this grade, you have to go to this school. Childhood has become this sort of utilitarian functional pursuit of college admission, according to some narrow band of, you know, what colleges and careers matter. And it's just so limited and narrow, it's harming our kids. So I just, you know, want to encourage every parent listening, the minute you get the inclination that your kid feels that they are their grades and scores, that their worth is, you know, only apparent when they're getting A's, you've got a problem on your hand. And you can do something to be a part of the solution. You know, get your kid out of that environment, be really clear about what does matter in your family in terms of character and hard work, not A's and perfect scores. Their mental health is suffering from these narrow definitions of success, and I think nobody understands that better than a Palo Alto parent.
Mm, I love it. Everyone has a little bit different path and a little bit different journey, and just because it was different than how yours was doesn't mean that it's the wrong path and can't lead to a happy, fulfilled, and great life.
Exactly.
I love
100%.
It. Yay. We're going to tag the TED Talk. Everyone needs to go and watch it. It's so
Thank
good.
You.
We're
going
to do the books. Is there any other place that people should go check out if they want to check out the things that are in your orbit? Is there a website?
There is. JulieLifcott-Hames.com. That's my whole name without the hyphen.com. I'm Jay Lifcott Hames everywhere on social media. I probably spend the most time interacting with people on Instagram if you like to be there, Jay Lifcott Hames. And I write a periodic newsletter called Julie's Pod. Pod is in like the places we found for safety in the pandemic. I try to write really vulnerably about what I experience and observe in life. And so, you know, if you like short essays on me just, you know, being a vulnerable human, trying to normalize what we're all experiencing, you can subscribe to Julie's Pod, jlithcotthames.substack.com.
I love it. We will. Thank you so much. This was so fun. We'll definitely have to do it again. And then if you're going to be running for president or anything else coming
nope,
up,
I'm sticking
let us know
right
so we can blast
City
it out.
Council. Appreciate it, Jesse. And
you're
again,
amazing.
Thanks to you and all your listeners. Like, really enjoyed. Like, people have choices, right? More choices than ever about media content. So I'm grateful, as I know you are, to whomever decided to take a chance on this conversation and who's still with us listening now and hopefully got something good out of it.
Amazing. All right, everybody. We'll catch you next time.